This program is presented by a community producer through Midland Community Television. The City of Midland and MCTV are not responsible for the content of the program. The views presented do not necessarily represent those of the City of Midland or MCTV. If you would like to produce your own program, contact MCTV at 837-3474 or access our website, cityofmidlandmi.gov/MCTV.
Local productions seen on Delta College Public Media are made possible with support from viewers like you. Thank you.
Everyone, thank you for joining me for today's episode of Junior Doan's The Spark. I'm Junior Doan. My guest today is Mike Weilbacher, naturalist and author of Wild Philly, a nature guidebook of Philadelphia. Welcome, Mike. Mike, how did you get interested in this lush field?
Wow. I'm actually a kid of the first Earth Day back in 1970 when I'm like 11, 12 years old, 6th, 7th grade, and read a weekly reader about pollution in the environment. And I don't know what it was, but something about it captivated me. And this is the time of DDT and endangered species and lots of air pollution. So for that first Earth Day in 1970, I organized my school's cleanup of the local park on Long Island where I was growing up. And I knew then in seventh grade that I wanted to do environmental work. Went to college to do something environmental and discovered this thing called environmental education. And I've been teaching pretty much ever since. So it's like 40 years now I've been teaching about nature and the environment. So I'm a kid of Earth Day.
How marvelous to find something that young that motivates you so completely. That's truly a blessing. But what does environmental education, as a student, actually cover?
Yeah, as a student. So there's a couple of things. One is the content. So what is it about nature and the environment that people need to learn? So it's learning about ecology, it's learning about biology, natural history, all that, the plants and animals that live around us. And then there's the other piece, the process by which people learn. So essentially, you're learning how to be a teacher, but the content that you're using is the environment. So I know in Midland, there's a wonderful Chippewa Nature Center.
True.
So that specializes in environmental education. So environmental educators are everywhere. We're sort of unsung, but we're everywhere.
Do you teach differently than you did in the first 10 years?
Probably. I think the big change for me now is that climate change was not an issue when I was starting out. That was always something way in the future. And now that the future is here, we know that the climate issue is here. And so teaching about climate has become increasingly important. And one key to this is to teach with that immediacy and urgency to like high school kids and adults, college students, but to not burden five-year-olds with that issue. So five-year-olds still need to play in nature and look at ants and walk in a forest and hold a leaf and smell a flower. And they don't have to worry about those kinds of big issues yet. So so my teaching is almost sort of bifurcated, that I'm talking one way to older students and a very different way to younger ones.
At what age do you switch to the older? What age can they take it or is interested in it?
Yeah, they'll tell you for
Oh,
one. So
really?
different kids are at different times. But oh, yeah. So if you're a teacher in a classroom, when they ask you these questions, that's when you know you could begin to give answers. And I know people like Greta Thunberg, the Swedish activist, she's really young, and so she's lowered the age by which students are really interested in those issues. So I think by middle school, students are probably interested in talking about it, complex environmental issues. But the piece is they need to understand some of the science before they get into sort of the politics and the activism piece of it. So, you know, the kids need a foundation of environmental science before they can begin to explore some of the complex political pieces of this.
It seems there are several versions of environmental science. How does one, as a beginner, figure out which are the reputable ones?
Well, I think there's really only one version of environmental science, but there are many interpretations of that science. So I
I
think that's the
see.
difference. So that people who are in the science are pretty united about where what the science is telling us. So the science is telling us very strongly a number of things, and I think people actually can look around them and use their own senses to deduce that things are changing on the climate science. I think everybody sees it. It's a question of, you know, wanting to acknowledge it, and then acting on that as well. So for me, you know, the evidence is all in. The science is in, the politics is not.
Do you find that people ask different questions now? Because you've taught in a wide variety of spaces.
Yeah, yes and no. And I think that there still people are really intrigued by the plants and animals that live around us, and we all know so surprisingly little about them. So, you know, each tree, each flower, each insect, each animal has an extraordinary life story. And so we just live in neighborhoods immersed in nature. And, you know, people are always asking about the plants and animals that live around us. And I love sharing our life stories. So that, you know, you see a firefly flashing, and, you know, it's great to know that that's a male firefly flashing. He's flashing to attract a female. The females are flightless because they're burdened with eggs and they can't fly. So they're hanging out in the leaves and on the trees looking for the right flash. And each species of firefly has its own unique code. It's Morse code. So it's doing three dots. It's doing a J going up. And the female's looking for the right question, the right species. And she has the right answer. She's got a secret code that she responds back. So when the male firefly sees the right answer, he comes down and mates. It's a great story, and it's the kind of thing that all of us should know about our natural neighbors.
Me especially, because when I was growing up in Oklahoma in a house that was built, I think, in the 20s, we'd sit on the front porch and rock and watch the fireflies at night, and gradually fewer and fewer and fewer. And now I don't really see any, but it isn't clear why, because we're not in a developed area. I mean, more developed area. There are no high rises and so forth. Have you a thought or information?
Yeah, well, there actually are fewer fireflies than there were, and there's a lot of theories, and the science of this one is still not settled. So they're still trying to work it out. But one of the issues is there's so much light pollution at night that the night is not as dark as it used to be. So it's harder for fireflies to see each other because of that. And simply development. If you live in highly developed places, it's harder for fireflies to find the habitat that they need. So there's at least two working theories and several more.
Some environmentalists and others seem to believe or come down on the sides that growing the population isn't a good idea worldwide. Others take the opposite. Is it better if that population shrinks or grows?
Yeah, as an educator, I am neutral on that. And actually, because that topic is so complex and overloaded with both sociology and psychology and politics. Not many of us actually tiptoe into those conversations because they are so loaded. But the truth is that many environmental scientists have made the case that the Earth, that the human population of the Earth is pretty close to carrying capacity, if not overshooting it. And if we wish to keep millions of plants and animal species with us, we need to reconfigure how we do that. And population is one piece of that puzzle. The other piece is learning how to create cities that are more ecologically friendly and more biologically diverse. Humankind is retracting into cities now anyway, which is actually, oddly enough, opening up spaces for other plants and animals to live in places where people are leaving. So we're actually, humanity is leaving many places and moving into cities. So the question is, how do we design and develop cities that make sense ecologically and from an energy perspective? So that's a huge issue that's overlaid with a lot of different things.
I read a lot about artificial intelligence and robots and things like that. Does that have any application to your field that you think would be helpful?
That's the big conversation in the culture right now, but no, I don't know for sure. I don't know what impact that'll have on environmental education at all.
Do you think that people who go into nature are more inclined to be introverts rather than extroverts?
I think that all of us, I think that people from across that spectrum of introvert, extrovert, and enter the field of nature and environmental education without question.
I'm a journalist, but I read widely. And in some areas, there's talk about hugging a tree to rebalance or be on grass and allow the magnetism of the earth to ground you, as they call it. Have you followed any of that?
A little bit. There is some science here in that spending time in green, in nature, in a forest, calms you, lowers your blood pressure, lowers your heart rate, elevates your mood. Kids learn better when they're learning outside, they retain it longer. There's a landmark study of actually in a Philadelphia suburb of gallbladder patients. One cohort of them looked out a window onto a brick wall. Another cohort looked out on a window that saw a tree, just a tree. The ones who saw the tree got better faster. They took less pain medication. They weren't in pain as much. And they didn't complain as much to the nursing staff. Their moods were better. And there are similar studies that show kids learn better if they can see a tree out the classroom window. Isn't that crazy? Kids learn better if they hear bird song. I mean, so we are
Talk about that.
hardwired.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, we are hardwired to be in nature. Another scientist, another Japanese researcher sprayed the chemical from pine trees, pinene. Sprayed it in a
Yeah.
nursery in Japan where newborns were. They'd never been outside. Just smelling pine in the air, the newborns lowered their blood pressure. They chilled out. The babies chilled out. So we are hardwired for this. Another scientist looked at the NK cells. These are white blood cells, natural killers. They cruise our bloodstream looking for things like cancer cells to kill. They had a higher level of NK cells. Of these white blood cells after spending time forest bathing. So forest bathing has caught on, but it looks like there's incredible health benefits. One can even make the case that spending a little bit of time in nature each week will help you live longer.
That's good news.
That's good news.
Has it been institutionalized? I don't think how. Oh, no. Let me ask you this first. Is looking at a tree out of a hospital window better or neutral as looking at a picture of a tree on the shade?
That's a great question. I'm not sure. I think it's better. I'm not 100% sure, to be honest with you. They didn't add that piece to the experiment. That's funny.
I've always wondered, my general theory is you look at something beautiful to you, a cloud, almost anything, it changes you some way, you know, for the better, for the worse, depends what you say.
They did a study where they, in a big corporate office, they put in green plants in the office. The people in the office were happier. They felt less, they felt like their workload wasn't as hard, and they stayed longer. So just putting green plants in a workplace made people happier.
That's surprising. So if you want people to shop, put plants in your store?
Absolutely. Yes, because they'll be elevated, they'll feel happier, and they'll go buy that.
Tell us a little more about what you've read in this general category of things we don't know but are interesting either in a health way or an attitude way.
So I think one study showed that the benefits of nature are, it's not like you need to go into a nature preserve. You just need to walk around your block and see some trees. So another, there are studies that show, this is crazy, that the murder rate in cities is lower in places where there are trees. So trees actually elevate the mood of the people who live in the neighborhood, and they're less inclined to hurt each other. The crime rate is lower and the murder rate is lower in places where there are more trees. So Philadelphia, for example, has a strategic plan for greening with street planting street trees. And a piece of this is for climate change to sequester carbon. But a piece of this is the health implications, which is that people will be happier and healthier in Philadelphia, and the crime rate will go down. It's crazy.
Well, it's certainly novel. And if true widely, you know, definitely is the thing whoever is involved in that part of life ought to consider. I think the big thing in cities is they have to keep the trees alive, but a good idea. I've always wondered, what is the purpose of cockroaches or fire ants? Do you know anything that you could tell me, or viruses like COVID, that I don't want to say justifies, but shows a plus that I'm unaware of?
You know, there's that famous hymn, "All God's Creatures Got a Place in the Choir," right?
Yes.
So essentially, life on Earth evolves if there is a niche for it to occupy, if there's a role for it to play in the ecosystem. So viruses evolved and discovered that, you know, it's not that the world needs viruses, it's that the viruses have discovered there's, you know, millions of hosts that they can infect. And, you know, the challenge for a virus from a virus's perspective is not to kill the host, because that gets rid of the virus. So yeah, there's a lot of species that people wonder about why they evolved in the first place. I mean, no organism pretty much has spread more disease than the mosquito. And yet the mosquito is food for literally millions of species of other animals. So the dragonfly, one of its nicknames is the mosquito hawk. Bats are cruising the night skies looking for mosquitoes. Frogs eat mosquitoes. There are insects underwater that eat mosquito larvae and pupae that are living underwater before they come out as adult mosquitoes. So there's a whole ecosystem of critters adapted for eating mosquitoes, but there are still mosquitoes who bite us. So yeah, there are millions of plants and animals across the planet. Some are beneficial to us and some sadly are not.
Can you say something positive about cockroaches?
They will
outlast. Is that funny?
So, you know, here's one of the funny things about humankind is that we give a creature like the cockroach innumerable things to eat, because it can generally eat everything. We give them innumerable places to hide in cities, and then we act surprised that there are so darn many of them. So we do this a lot where we create the right habitat for species, and then we act. Look at that, we have too many of them. You know, white-tailed deer. At the turn of the 18th into 19th century, there were very few white-tailed deer in North America, but now forests have regrown and regenerated. There are second-growth forests interspersed in suburbia, and so we've given deer the habitat they need. The small forest next to the open space of our lawns, and in our lawns we put all the plants that they love to eat, like hosta. And then we've taken away all their predators. So we've gotten rid of mountain lions and wolves. So we've taken away their predators, given them their habitat, given them their food, and then we're surprised that there's too many white-tailed deer in America right now. So, you know, I think if I would love to, I would advocate for higher ecological literacy among people, that ecology should be one of the three R's, that we should be learning about the plants, animals that live alongside us, because then we wouldn't be doing these things that we can be, you know, these same mistakes that we continually make.
Well, perhaps we'll learn from the animals and the plants some medical approach that we haven't thought of before. I keep reading that plants have been used as medicines before we were in the lab creating medicines. So I think we live in wonderful times, because the advances, or at least the information, is multiplying so quickly. I tell my friends who are seriously ill, your job is to live as long as possible, because the medical side is coming forward with treatments that were unimagined even a couple of years ago. So what are some of the questions that are asked of you that surprise you?
You know, I can't say I have a lot of questions that surprise me. But I know that I've gotten more questions about climate in the last couple of years than I had before that. I think more people are more interested in more information now, because when we go through weird floods and big hurricanes, you know, in Philadelphia has some severe flooding in some of our highways. One of our underground highways became essentially a whitewater rapid, and that's unusual for the city of Philadelphia. So I'm getting more questions about climate than I ever used to, and that's a good thing. So I'm happy that people are asking these questions, and I'm happy to be able to provide it.
So it seems like all cultures that grow vegetables celebrate the harvest. We do, it goes back to the Bible, which means that the harvest wasn't necessarily assured every year, dependent on weather. Do we really know more about weather, like we're having a cold snap and then less snow or whatever? And how can we tell that we're just not going to have 50 years of this and then it'll change the other way?
So there's lots of models that are out there. Lots of scientists are doing modeling based on if we're doing A and B, then C will happen. And the models are becoming increasingly sophisticated. And maybe that's where artificial intelligence will be helping with climate modeling. So maybe we'll get a more finessed version of climate modeling as we move forward. So, you know, I think that we do know that temperature is warming. We do know that rainfall is changing. I know that Philadelphia is wetter now than it used to be. And the intensity of the storms in Philadelphia has changed dramatically in my time living here. So we get more rain and it comes in more intense downpours. So there's just lots of data about this, and there's lots of different measurements. One of the things people can do is actually become citizen scientists, and they can help measure this data themselves. So on your smartphones there are lots of apps you can use and begin contribute to the data that scientists are collecting on things like climate. So, you know, become a citizen scientist.
A few decades ago there was worry we'd be going into an ice age, and that vanished. What are your thoughts on that possibility?
I mean, I was taught that in college, but that's a long time ago. So yeah, the conventional wisdom back then was that we were in an interglacial period and the glacier was coming back because we only 10,000 years ago came out of a glacier. So the earth is always changing, but what that doesn't what's not remembered in that conversation is that we have radically altered the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So it has increased 50%. Since the Industrial Revolution started. So when we've supercharged carbon dioxide, so that is likely going to alter when another ice age comes. And if it does come, it's not for millions of years. So that's deep in the future. In the immediate future, we have a different climate issue to worry about.
Thank you so very much, Mike. I've really learned a lot, and you're a lucky person because you fell in love with a career or a field very early at 12 when you went out to an Earth Day event, and you stayed with it, and the field developed with you, and you were part of the development of the field. So thank you very much. And everybody else, remember, do something kind for someone you know and someone you don't know, and do it again tomorrow. See you next time.
To contact Junia, send her an email at juniadonesthespark@gmail.com. For more information, program schedules, and news about future guests, go to www.juniadonethespark.com. Thank you for joining us. See you next time on Junia Dones the Spark.
Local productions seen on Delta College Public Media are made possible with support from viewers like you. Thank you.
This program is presented by a community producer through Midland Community Television. The City of Midland and MCTV are not responsible for the content of the program. The views presented do not necessarily represent those of the City of Midland or MCTV. If you would like to produce your own program, contact MCTV at 837-3474 or access our website, cityofmidlandmi.gov/MCTV. We hope you enjoy the following presentation.